This is Phyllis Weisbar, the Women's Studies Library, not only for the general library system, but for the UW system statewide. Is that right, Phyllis?
Right.
Okay. So the first thing we'll do is ask Phyllis some questions, and she can answer them as she sees fit, and we'll take it from there. You want to start with your background, before you came here, and why you're here, you think you're here anyway?
Okay, sure. Well, going way back, I grew up in Green Bay, and I came here to the university as an undergraduate. I was here 1964 to 1968, which were very active political years on campus. I was involved a little bit more peripherally, but certainly more on the side of politics than not during those years. And I got a degree, my major was American Institutions, which I don't think exists as a major anymore. But it was a good major for people who couldn't figure out what they wanted to major in. And I got a very broad background in social sciences in particular. And I got a degree also in secondary education and student taught American history at Madison's West High during that time. As part of the American Institutions program, I think we only had two courses that were required, and those were seminars in the program, and the rest was all electives across much of the campus, it seemed like. So, sure.
You said you taught women's history at Madison West.
Not women's history, no. Yeah. No women's history yet. No women much of anything yet. Right, you're right. No, it was American history. I think I taught the unit on the causes of the Civil War, actually. And a student taught for Burton Hobley, who was the football coach. And he was actually happy to have student teachers because then he could be, he was in the back of the room, he was listening, but he was also figuring out his football plays. So he basically let me, you know, do my thing.
So you're probably responsible for their good record.
I suppose so, right. That's true. Back to these seminars that we had. The professor who ran the program, his name was William O'Neill. And so we had a seminar with him, and he had us read critiques of American society, and then we wrote critiques ourselves on these critiques. So one of them that we read was Betty Friedan's book, The Feminine Mystique. And I think that influenced me a lot because it just rang so true, her whole analysis. So if I was taking a turn to the feminist, I think it really dawned from that that reading for that class in American Institutions. And then I moved away. After I graduated, I went to Hebrew University in Jerusalem for a year. And wanted to pursue Jewish studies. I'd also minored in Hebrew here. And Jewish studies has been an enduring interest of mine throughout my life. But I came back after the year and wasn't so sure I wanted to do that degree. I didn't really know what to do. I have a lot of those things of floundering in the early years. And I ended up working in the Yale Library cataloging Hebrew books. And during that year, I then decided I did want to go to graduate school. I applied to Harvard, among other places, in Jewish studies, called various names, and then I ended up the next year at Harvard in their program in Near Eastern Languages and Literatures. I stayed there a year, and I decided that really wasn't for me. It probably wasn't the right choice of graduate program. It was heavily medieval. It really required a lot of background in classic Jewish texts that I didn't really have. They were certainly willing to let me continue and get it, the background to actually do the kind of work they were requiring of graduate students, but I didn't have it in me. Didn't want to do it. So then I did some jobs around in the Boston area, including working at Harvard Hillel for a year. Then I got a master's in health education at Boston University, pursued that career for several years, doing kind of health administration and education in various places. I guess, let's see, what did I do? I could go through all my jobs. I don't know. I have a lot of them. I mean, it all ties in terms of my eventual job as women's studies librarian, because I have a lot of background in lots of different things that I do draw on for this job, because women's studies can be basically anything that women are involved in. So the fact that I've got this health stuff and the Jewish stuff and a few other things actually has been helpful. I got married along the way there, and we moved to Dallas. Well, first we moved to New Haven, where my husband went to law school, and I had some of these health ed jobs. And then we moved to Dallas for a year when he did his legal clerkship, and I worked for the Regional Planning Agency and Alcoholism Services. Then we moved to D.C. when he took a job in D.C., and then I had a few part-time jobs in librarianship, and basically have been in librarianship ever since. I was a synagogue librarian, very part-time, was able to bring my baby with me, did that for a year or so, year and a half maybe. And then one day I got a call from a professor friend who actually has a Wisconsin connection too. This is Max Tickton, who was the Hillel director here at Wisconsin for I think about 25 years before my time as a student, but I knew him anyway. And he moved to D.C. and he was at that time a professor of Hebrew literature. So he got some kind of a notice from Library of Congress that they needed someone part-time in their Hebraic section. He let me know about the job, which I then applied for and got. So I stopped being the synagogue librarian. Instead, I was a part-time reference librarian in the Hebraic section of the Library of Congress. Now, all this is still without any library courses, which is something that I know David Hennig thinks is just fine. So, I worked there. I really loved that job. I learned a lot. I had a wonderful supervisor who was a consummate scholar and taught me a lot. We had lots of interesting questions, because basically we got anything, any letter anybody sent to the Library of Congress that involved Jews, Israel, Bible, whatever it is. And then we tried to answer it. And of course, if there was something, a letter to a congressperson, those went to the top of the list. And occasionally there were some of those written in Yiddish or something. I don't really know Yiddish much, but one of my colleagues did. And another one was a question from Orrin Hatch, who still, to this day, is a senator. And he had heard that his name, Orrin, was a Hebrew word, and he wanted to know if that was true and what it meant. So we answered that for him. Yes, it was. And we had, you know, more serious questions from scholars and helped them with the resources that the Library of Congress has in abundance for doing Jewish studies. And then my family and I moved again to New Jersey, and after about a year of being home with my now two little children, I got a call from someone at Jewish Theological Seminary. They needed a part-time librarian for their education outfit called the Melton Research Center. I ended up doing that again. I don't remember how long, a year or two, something like that, part-time. And as you can hear, like, I sort of got called about jobs or fell into them a little bit. This is now the second one like that. The third one, while I was at Jewish Theological Seminary, I got a call from the librarian of the seminary saying he had been asked to recommend someone, the law librarian at New York University Law Library needed someone fast as a consultant to build a Jewish law collection for them. They had just gotten a lot of money for a visiting chair in Jewish law, and they needed a part-time consultant to help them. And so I ended up jumping ship from the seminary and then working what turned out to be 6 years at NYU Law Library, building a Jewish law collection in conjunction with their first visiting professor, Menachem Elon, who was also a sitting justice on the Israeli Supreme Court, but a scholar in his own right in Jewish law. And he had certain ideas about what the collection should have, and I basically concurred and carried out his wishes and worked with a cataloger to get it cataloged and all of that. So that was, again, a job that I enjoyed quite a bit. Back a step, I had one other consulting job at Cardozo Law School, also helping them figure out what to do for a Jewish law collection there. At any rate, then we moved to Madison because my husband took a job here teaching in the law and medical schools. There, too, there was a two-step movement here. First, he did a visit in 1987, so we were here for a semester, and I decided that maybe it was time to start working on a library degree, that maybe what I actually was a librarian. And even though it had not been a barrier to my getting professional jobs, not having the degree, it seemed like a good idea to get the degree. So during that semester in 87, I took three courses in the library school here and started on the degree road. We then went back to New Jersey for 3 years and then came back here on a permanent basis in the summer of 1990. I then re-enrolled in the library school and finished my degree in the fall of 1991, at which point I was on the job market here. The job of the women's studies librarian was open that fall on what was advertised as a temporary basis, a six-month job, because there were a lot of temporary or people in slots that time frame, including the director of the general library system. Ken Frazier was in a interim capacity. My predecessor, Susan Searing, had been tapped by Ken to be his head of public services or kind of a deputy director. I'm not sure what her title was. And that also was on an interim or acting basis. And so the women's studies job, which Sue wanted to come back to should hers not work out, was advertised on an acting basis for 6 months. They did do a little bit of quote-unquote national search. I think they put it on a listserv or two. But otherwise, they didn't do a lot of national advertising because it's a very, very, very plum job for women's studies librarianship, the plum job, really. But the fact that well, I was here, that helped. So having a six-month job wasn't a barrier to me. It may have been a barrier to other people out of the area. They wanted someone who'd had publication experience. And in the course of my NYU job, I published a book, a bibliography on Jewish law in English, co-published that with a scholar and lawyer in Jerusalem. And they also wanted administrative experience, which I had had in my health education career. I ran a health screening program in Connecticut for 2 years. And they wanted, of course, some feminist something. But at that point in 1991, they weren't yet requiring a degree in women's studies, since so few people really had that plus a library degree. So I had had, or I parlayed what I had, my conversion to feminism through having read Betty Friedan's book, and also some Jewish feminist activities that I had been involved in. And so I was fortunate enough to be hired in this acting capacity and start in November of 1991 with a job. Yeah, so I did get to meet some of the librarians and get familiar as a professional with the libraries on campus when I was asked by Professor Ken Sachs, who was a professor in the history department and involved in Jewish studies on the campus, to do a kind of an assessment of the libraries with respect to Jewish studies. So I did a document. I mean, I looked up things. I visited with some people, both in Memorial Library and in the Historical Society, and identified what I thought were some gaps in the existing collection. So in the course of that, I did meet you, David, and I met Lou Pitchman, and I probably met someone at Historical, although I don't actually remember. I may have just, you know, pushed the catalog and noticed, because I think more of what I was concerned about at the time, and I just sort of did some categories like Zionism. I think Jewish women was another category I kind of assessed as examples. And it seemed that given the Historical Society's purview, which includes kind of contemporary American issues and ethnicities, that more of the gaps were due to their gaps. But I think I had some others too. I haven't gone back to read that document. Anyway, I guess that did get my name into the knowledge of the librarians. I don't really know if that had anything to do with my subsequently getting hired, because I don't think either David or Lou were part of the search and screen committee. I don't know if they put in any words or they were even aware of that search at the time. I don't know. Were you? Do you remember?
I don't remember.
You don't remember,
I
yeah.
I suspect I might have been just to see what, this is my responsibility in the Near East, but it was very peripheral, very peripheral.
Yeah.
So you got the job. I didn't get the job for you.
Yeah, no, okay. Anyway, but I had done that, and that had helped me get familiar, you know, at least with the Jewish sources. And I did tell the committee that, you know, I mean, that was my strong interest, Jewish feminism, and, you know, if there was an opportunity for doing professional work in a subject allied with women's studies, I would probably do it in that direction. And I have, in fact, done that throughout the job upon occasion. I could go back a little bit. There were some other clues to my becoming a librarian, too, even though I hopped around a lot with graduate programs and jobs and everything. When I was an undergraduate here, the summer between my junior and senior years, I had a job with the Madison City Bookmobile. And there, I know there isn't, at some point, the city bookmobile service ended, but at that point there still was one. And we went to different neighborhoods around the city and set up the bookmobile. And I was the page, which meant that I did the record keeping, and a lot of this was still mostly offline. I mean, there was some help from computers, but it wasn't, I'm not sure what anymore existed then, but I think we got sort of printouts, like maybe it was from our mainframe or something, and I had to cross them off so we knew which books had come back in, things like that, which I did back in the office, which was in the basement of the central library. So I did have an undergraduate library job in effect. And I suppose that also pointed me towards librarianship. So I think that's most of what, you know, some of my background can tell you about. I could talk a little about my library school experience. I could talk a little about my library school experience here in SLIS. I really enjoyed it a lot. I had, I think, excellent teachers. I did learn things, and they also were quite flexible. They recognized that I had had several years of specialized professional library experience. So I was able to place out of certain courses. I took some others by examination. And so really the then year or so I spent, it's this one when we returned to Madison in 1990, I was able to take advanced courses. And just like my kind of eclectic background across the board in different subjects, I think helps me in my job as women's studies librarian. The kinds of things I took in the library school, I've really drawn on all of them. I took a broad range, including young adult literature, and I get questions about, you know, books for girls, or, you know, how do you assess books for girls, and I can draw on what I learned in that class. Government documents, I mean, it's a world unto itself, and having understanding of how those documents work and where they are and all of that, I think, is quite valuable, since I get a lot of questions on statistics on women and gender and other topics where the government plays in. I took a preservation course, which of course is important, being a responsible for certain materials in the library now. I took reference. I took a couple of courses in the archives track. I think that also is especially valuable when I work with helping researchers doing women's history in particular now, having an understanding of how libraries and archives differ from each other and how to go about finding archival material. So those are really very valuable, and even just knowing the terminology I think makes it easier for me to help people. I took advanced cataloging, which I really enjoyed, and having a good understanding of the possibilities and I know we did a lot of critiquing of the Library of Congress subject headings, and those give me a better understanding of what my cataloging colleagues do. And now that I've been on a lot of committees of late involving ebooks and involving our new catalog, and really I do draw on that basic or more than basic understanding I have of what goes into the MARC record. So even that. So I really had a good time. I don't think there was a dud that I recall in the classes at all. And I also had some good colleagues. There were a group of us somewhat older women that hung out together. Some of those friendships have persisted also, and that was also valuable. And so sometimes I'm asked by SLIS students, you know, what they should take so they could become a women's studies librarian. Or, you know, an academic librarian, period. And I still recommend a broad selection of courses, because you just don't know what job you're actually going to get, or jobs over the career. So I don't think people can go wrong spreading themselves around in the library school experience. People, because, yeah. David's asked me to mention a few of those people who I am still in touch with from the library school gang. And that includes Linda Fain, who I hired several years ago to work part-time for my office. And she edits our new books on women, gender, and feminism. And she also edits our database of women's videos. So she had moved away from Madison and then back again, and was available at a time starting as an LTE at that point, when I had some money to pay her. So we have ended up working very closely together over several years at this point. Ann Combs, who's a librarian in the Health Sciences Library, the Ebeling Library, is also part of that group, and she, you know, she and I, although we don't have a lot of direct contact, occasionally we're on a committee or something, and we certainly reminisce about our library school careers. So those are two from that era. Do you want me to just continue with this job, or what would you like? So the 6 months on the acting women's studies librarian job turned into 3 years before enough had come to pass that it could be advertised on a permanent basis. And that included the director job, did go to Ken Frazier on a permanent basis, and then the deputy director or the head of public services job went to Sue Searing on a permanent basis. And then it was possible for the women's studies job to be advertised for the permanent position. So by that point, if there was a weakness in my background in terms of women's studies experience, I had 3 years of experience doing it, so I was in a very good position to get the job on a permanent basis. They did do more of a national search that time, and they did bring in, I think, somebody from somewhere else. At any rate, I was fortunate to get the position on a permanent basis and be able to essentially continue where I was. So the office is a very interesting office, and you know, rather than just referring to women's studies librarian, it's really a whole operation. And that's because it was started as and continues as a statewide, or at least system-wide, the University of Wisconsin system-wide office. It started back in the 1970s when the women's studies programs around the state were also getting going. It has a pretty interesting history. I learned it in detail when the head of the statewide Women's Studies Consortium had me do a self-study of our office shortly after I started the job. And that really got me going through all of the documents and understanding the history and trying to see, you know, where we would want to be going in future directions, but I needed to have a good understanding of the past. So it was kind of a pain to do, but I'm glad she, and that was Jacqueline Ross, made me do that. The office started out in, so the people who worked on it did so starting in, I think, 1974 or so. There had been, a statewide conference about women's studies and various teaching faculty from around the UW system and librarians went to that. And they really were at the beginning of trying to figure out what would be taught in women's studies courses. There were a few of those around. What might constitute a program. And then they also were worried about, you know, what would the resources, the library materials be to support these courses and eventual research as well. So some of these people started meeting after that conference, and they thought, gee, wouldn't it be great if we could get our own librarian who knew something about the material and could help us figure out, like, what do we have in our libraries now on women? Gender wasn't in the picture yet, so I'm just going to use women. Eventually to help us find, you know, the new stuff, what's the good stuff, how do we find it, where is it, what should we buy, all of that. So that was one motivation. Another motivation was that these women, I think they were all women, there might have been a man, but I think they were all women, they also realized that they had not a clue about how things get funded in the university, like a new initiative. None of these people, to the best of my knowledge, had had any administrative experience. They were, like I said, they were teaching faculty and librarians. So they thought, maybe we can take this idea of having a system-wide librarian and use it as a vehicle to learn how the UW system funds new initiatives. And the system wasn't around all that long either. It had come into being, I think, in 1971, unifying the campuses around the state, but still having a lot of autonomy at the local campus levels. At any rate, they did that. They learned that there was a certain procedure for proposing a new initiative, decision item narrative is what it's called, a DIN. They created one. They had to learn how to create a budget. They didn't know how to do that. They submitted it. So I think the first year they submitted it, no DINs were funded. But they resubmitted it, and it actually got funded the next year as a system initiative and paid for with system funds. So the first librarian was hired in 1977, she got things going. The idea was that this would be temporary money from system, and then they'd see how it would go. They did place the office physically on the Madison campus, I think initially in the Wills office, because that's also a statewide organization, the Wisconsin Library Services. And I think the supervision came through the Wills office for some time. At any rate, that first librarian was successful. Her name was, it'll come to me, Esther Steineman. She later had a different last name, I was trying to think of, but anyway, she was the first one. She went around and visited campuses and got to know people and was quite active for 2 or 3 years. And then there was another librarian, Linda Parker, also for 2 or 3 years. Susan Searing was hired, and her tenure was between 9 and 10 years, I think closer to 10 years. And then me. So that's it. Those are the only people who have had this position. Esther and maybe more so Linda realized that to reach people around the entire system, they couldn't just be traveling all the time and doing it through their own presentations and all. They could reach a lot more people if they did publications. So they started three of them, which Sue continued, and I've really continued, although they're more online and they look a little different these days. They were all started around 1979-80. So that's why I'm not sure how much it was Esther or how much it was Linda. So we'll just say both of them had, the ideas in executing these things. So one of them is called New Books on Women and Feminism, now called New Books on Women, Gender, and Feminism. At any rate, that one is a bibliography of books in English that come out in sort of a 6-month period. It had been a twice a year publication for many years. Now there's so many books coming out, we're down to more like once a year, but at any rate, that's an ongoing publication. So that kind of fulfills, what's the new stuff generally, so the librarians around the system can use it as a selection tool. And the professors can also know, since it's divided up into broad subject categories as well as having a detailed subject index, they can kind of browse like what's coming out in a particular part of the field, since the field is so vast, since women are, or women's studies, there's really a portion of it in all disciplines. They're able to browse that way, as can students, of course, too. So that was one of them. Then to come up with a way to talk about what's coming out in the periodical literature, they started something called Feminist Periodicals, a current listing of contents. And at that time, it was simply reproducing the tables of contents by photocopying them and stapling them together from about, I'm not sure how many there were in the first several issues, 25, maybe 30 publications, because just as these programs were getting off the ground, publications were as well. There were not too many academic journals yet in the 70s, but there were plenty of grassroots publications, and that's what the early feminist periodicals tables of contents came from. And then over time, as academic journals started, such as Women's Studies Quarterly and Women's Studies International Forum, and then ones that were in more specific disciplines, feminism and psychology, for example, or Journal of Women's History. All of these tables of contents, with permission, were put into this photocopied and stapled quarterly called Feminist Periodicals. And we continue to do that. It's now online only. And then the third publication is called Feminist Collections, a quarterly of women's studies resources. And this one has content. This has a lot of book reviews, audiovisual material reviews, eventually reviews of online material, websites, blogs, whatevers, and some articles about the new technologies and how to apply them or use them effectively for women's studies teaching and research. So that one has required more editorial work with all these reviews and other materials that are actually, it's writing. So early on, someone was responsible for editing. I think that was Catherine Loeb first, if I know the history a little bit. Then for many years, it was Linda Schult. And for about the last maybe 10 years now, it's been Joanne Lehman. So they are people with editing experience. They've done it on a full or part-time basis, and that's part of the existing staff of the office. We also have a full-time assistant. The formal title of that position now is Office Operations Associate, who manages our publications, since we do have subscribers and we need to manage the income from that and other aspects of subscription roles. So for many years, that was Ingrid Markart, also known as Ingrid Swanberg. And again, for I'm not sure how many years, 6, 7, 8, it's been Heather Schimmann. So that's been a very important position, really, to keep things going in the office with this whole publication program, and especially since the librarian is manager of the office, that's only a part of the duties, but there's a lot of work within the general library system as a librarian, and other duties connected with being part of the UW system, Women's Studies Consortium, which I can talk more about specifically. Let me see if there's anything else I was going to think about saying in terms of the running of the office and all that. We also have a database that started out as part of, I guess it might have been part of New Books on Women and Feminism, but it was a section about non-print resources, and basically it was about films and eventually videos. So we spun that off. Let me go back up to the history a little bit. So that office started out, like I said, on a temporary basis, and then system was satisfied that it was a success. And I should say that all the way through, there's been an advisory panel to the office made up of teaching faculty and librarians, kind of half and half from around the system. So they, I think, petitioned for it to become a permanent office, and they were successful at that. So at that time, and I think that was around 1980 also, the system transferred, I think, the salary of the librarian to the Madison budget. And that was the last time there was an influx of money in the operating budget that came from system. So any of the subsequent raises, of which there used to be some, have been handled by the general library system budget as part of the Madison campus. And the permanent home, the general library system agreed to be the home for the office and to supply supervision and everything else. And so any of these other people who've been part of the office, including students, we have a student budget, we have supplies, and we have other people. These have all been handled by the Madison campus or the general library system, part of the Madison campus. We do have income that comes in, and that defrays some of it. We especially have some royalties that come in from a database vendor, originally was called NISC. NISC was bought out by EBSCO, and we get generous by our standards, royalties from them for inclusion of the new books on women and gender citations in their Women's Studies International database. So that money at this point is used to defray the entire student budget. We don't draw on that at all from the general library system. It also provides us sufficient funds, of course, to plow back into our publications and travel. We do not draw on the increasingly limited travel budget for professional development that the general library system has to offer. So that has meant that I and Linda Schult and then Joanne Lehman, we've been able to attend the National Women's Studies Association annual conferences most years. I've attended quite a few of the American Library Association conferences as well, and we have paid for those out of those funds. We also get a little bit of royalty from a couple other vendors, again, for inclusion of our material in their databases, but the sizable one comes from what was originally a contract with NISC. And those contracts are things that also I was involved in negotiating, and with help from the legal services office on campus. It was then Henry Cuthbert that I worked with to negotiate those. And that was all an interesting experience, too. And they're still standing, these agreements that we have, and they bring in this income. So it means that I'm in an unusual position around the general library system in that I do have my own money to draw from and to decide on travel or other uses if we choose to. We have publicity expenses. Right now, Joanne and I are working with an artist to create a quilt banner for us that we can use in our booths. We put up booths at the National Women's Studies Association and at the State Women's Studies LGBT conferences. We show off our publications. We often end up giving away a lot of them, but we try to let people know what we're doing. And we want to have a new banner. So we have the funding from our income to do that.